Well, hey, welcome back to Country Fried Rock. We dug out a couple of old hard drives, found some of these old episodes from 2009 through 2020, and figured, what the hell, y'all should hear them. Ton of fantastic musicians and bands, many of whom are still out there making great music. I decided to just throw some of these old episodes back out there. They have not been re-edited, so half these places don't even exist anymore. Never mind the URLs, don't even bother. But a lot of these bands really made great music, and I want you to hear it. Dig them up on your favorite streaming service if you can't find them elsewhere, and go see a show if they're still playing. So if you're new to Country Fried Rock, starting back in 2009, this was a syndicated radio show that aired in more than 50 markets across the globe. The structure follows some of the format of older syndicated radio programs, and we left it that way. So we'll bounce around back into the archives and let us know if there's anybody in particular you'd like us to try to dig up off these extremely disorganized hard drives. No matter what, we sure appreciate you being here. You can toss some money in the tip jar or what the hell, join the fan club. But it's most important that you check out this music. It's all there for you these days on countryfriedrock.com and your favorite podcast app. Tell a friend, smash that follow button, and give us a 5-star rating and review. That hasn't changed, no matter how much my hair color and eyeglasses have. Thanks for being here. Hey, y'all, it's Sloane Spencer. Thanks so much for finding all these new old episodes of Country Fried Rock. I've got something completely different available these days called Sleep with Rock Stars. And it all started from a listener comment back in the very early days of Country Fried Rock who said, you know, I slow these down to 75% and fall asleep to them. And I was like, well, over the years, I started thinking about it, and I recently started Sleep with Rock Stars. It's the Gen X Sleep Podcast, and you can find it at sleepwithrockstars.com or your favorite podcast app.
Welcome to Country Fried Rock, where we talk with musicians to find out what inspires their creativity. Country Fried Rock, music uncovered. My guest today on Country Fried Rock is Kevin Gordon with a great new record, Gloryland. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you, Sloane.
Thank you for being with us. So, Kevin, how did you start playing music way back?
Well, I'd always been attracted to what I guess is called roots music now, or what would be called Americana, you know. My folks, they would have these parties at the house on the weekends, and they would be playing things like Jerry Lee Lewis or Ray Charles. And I just remember being immediately drawn to that music, rhythmically, you know, and as a 4- and 5-year-old would be dancing to those records. As I got older, I was still just as interested in music, and when I was in high school, started singing in what could be loosely described as a punk band. Didn't really know what I was doing, but, you know, I guess that's the point. to have fun and express yourself, you know, that's what we were doing, albeit mainly through covers, you know, Ramones and Sex Pistols stuff. And it was when I was in college, I guess. Well, I can remember when I started playing guitar as a senior in high school, almost immediately wanting to write songs. There was something about the connection between playing an instrument, and I was also heavily into poetry. So it was kind of like trying to put the two things I love together. That's what led to the mess I'm in now.
Then it ramped up for you pretty quickly as you found ways to set your lyrics and your music together. Where did that head for you in the early days?
In college, I was writing original songs, but they were still very much in the shadow of bands and artists that influenced me, like X. You know, and that's all kind of coming back around to the roots thing. Obviously, their music very grounded in American roots traditions, albeit with some of the weirdest chord changes ever. I say that with all affection and love. But I just kept writing, and when I moved to Iowa to go to graduate school in poetry, I had the great fortune of getting to know a guy named Bo Ramsey, who at that time was, you know, strictly a regional phenomenon, kind of took me under his wing and was and is a mentor and great friend. I basically got in his van and drove around the Midwest for a couple of years. Learned a lot, you know. That was a big turn for me back towards what would more obviously be called roots music. He was and is a big fan of blues and comes out of those traditions in his own way. So we were doing a lot of that stuff and listening to a lot of, you know, old Chess records in the van and doing original songs and trying to take that somewhere. I spent 5 years in Iowa City, went on to play in my own bands up there, and I just decided if I were going to try to do something with my music professionally that I needed to come to a so-called industry town. Nashville was, for me personally, at that time, the most palatable of the choices. I couldn't see moving to L.A. or New York. I was too much still the provincial guy from, you know, North Louisiana. So the obvious choices for me were Nashville or Austin. At that time, and still, the majority of the business community is here in Nashville. I woke up this morning, and it's 20 years later, and I'm wondering what happened. I like it here. It's a great city. My own neighborhood, East Nashville, has kind of come into its own as a kind of an artist enclave. It's kind of been amazing to see.
When you first moved up to Iowa for grad school, was that where your first culture shock kind of came in, or had you had experience outside of North Louisiana at that point?
Yeah, that was definitely my first time to live outside the South. So yeah, that first winter was pretty brutal. I actually, in mid-February of that first winter, I dug my Chevy S10 pickup out of the snow, which, as you know, is a fairly small vehicle, not well suited to driving on frozen road. Dug it out of 2 feet of snow, and myself and one of my classmates in the workshop from California drove to New Orleans for Mardi Gras. It was almost a physiological reaction to the weather. So it was definitely a change for me. It was a good thing, definitely a growing experience. It was kind of a two-headed thing in that, you know, I would go to, you know, my poetry workshop once a week or go to the classes I was taking, which were all kind of highbrow literary seminar kind of things. Mm-hmm. And then I'd come home and I remember I had this vinyl LP of live Eddie Cochran performances.
Ooh, yeah.
I think from his last tour before he was killed. He does a version of Milk Cow Blues on there, and I remember sitting there playing that solo over and over and learning it, playing along with, I had a double LP of Freddie King instrumentals. Same thing, you know, guys who didn't play so fast that your brain hurt trying to decipher what in the hell was happening, but played with great soul. So that was kind of the way things went then. Just the climbing in the van on the weekends was such a great release from, you know, sort of the what we used to refer to somewhat humorously as the compound. Hey, this is Kevin Gordon, and you're listening to Country Fried Rock.
I know nothing about the music scene in the northern Midwest, like the Iowa area.
I didn't realize it when I moved there, even though I was a fan of Chicago blues. I mean, I owned several Muddy Waters records, kind of knew about the Chess thing. I didn't realize when I moved to Iowa City that Chicago was only 200 miles away. You know, that for decades, a lot of those artists based in Chicago would play Iowa City and other towns in Iowa when they were heading west on a tour. You know, that's one thing I did while living there was you would get to see contemporary Chicago blues artists like Little Ed and the Imperials and Sun Seals. Yeah, it was just very odd. I didn't even think about that. But this was a guy who, you know, when I lived in Louisiana, seldom traveled more than, you know, 100 miles for a gig.
How then did you end up bringing some of this poetry that you had been working on, both academically and personally, bring that towards your blues?
I was always drawn to music that had interesting lyrics, be it Chuck Berry or be it, as I mentioned before, X, both great examples of songwriters who used language in provocative ways. Gosh, Chuck Berry, Nadine, you know, the verses to that are just incredible. You know, and it's not that I call them poetry. I actually pretty staunchly against calling them the same thing, mainly for, you know, formal reasons that, you know, in a song you can basically get away with murder lyrically with a good melody. I was always intrigued by that idea of just because it's a rock and roll song doesn't mean it can't carry some weight lyrically.
In your process, do you mentally differentiate that when you were writing poetry versus lyrics?
Oh, yeah. Not that I do both much anymore. I mean, rare is it that I work on poetry these days, unfortunately, but music has been pretty much all-consuming. I still read a lot of poetry, and I'm a fan, of course.
When did that switch for you?
When I moved to Nashville, pretty much immediately. And most of that was just, I guess, natural. You know, my girlfriend, now wife, and I moved here together, and we knew people here through various ways, but still, you're landing in a new town, and you're in a music town, and when you're a musician, it's easy to get nervous. So poetry began to take a backseat.
Because it's been quite a stretch of time at this point, there are naturally changes that occur over time in anyone's creative output. Where were you first feeling pulled, and how did that come out to the world for you?
When I first moved to Nashville, I'd say within a year, I had a publishing deal, which is basically where you're trying to write songs that will be commercially viable. And if you're living in this town, that means for the country music business. You know, luckily, this was with a guy who's basically a manager who I think was just trying to help me pay my rent for a year. while hoping that I would write something that one of his artists would cut. He had Leroy Parnell and Marty Brown and Pam Tillis. Pretty tasty roster. But that was also the worst creative year of my life, trying to get a cut, as if I would go through the people in their cubicles on Music Row and shaking hands and then sitting down and trying to rework some sort of cliche based in somebody's idea of rural living that's been done to death for 50 years. I just ended up not being interested in that at all because it was just dead to me.
So then this is the fun part.
After that, I started writing songs with a guy who would end up becoming one of my closest friends, Gwil Owen, with whom I've written quite a few songs, a number of which have been recorded by other artists or have been in films. We just worked really well together. We hit it off. You know, it was right then that I just sort of realized, okay, maybe I'm just supposed to do what I'm supposed to do. Just follow those songs where they take you, aesthetically. And Gwil was of the same mindset. He's a great editor. I would bring in a verse and a half and maybe an idea for a chorus and, okay, this is terrible. You know, and has a very transparent way of being the voice that the song is in. And it's been a lot of fun working with him over the years.
How does that language between you two develop to where it is now?
I think early on we were getting together fairly regularly, and I was also getting ready to record what would eventually become my first. I think it was through writing those first 7 or 8 songs that we kind of figured out the way to communicate with one another. It's hard to say what that means, although at this point I would say that we've done it enough that it's a completely natural thing, which helps the ideas show up. You know, you don't feel as shy about saying, well, how about this? And then it's, you know, the stupidest thing you've ever thought of. But it's all you got. Just a long working relationship and a long friendship makes the collaboration.
Several great musician friends of Country Fried Rock generously donated songs for a free music sampler. Download it at noisetrade.com/countryfriedrock. 19 songs to help raise awareness and money for Nucci Space, a nonprofit serving the mental health needs of musicians in the Athens, Georgia area. Find out more about Nucci's at nuci.org. So what was leading to that first record then?
First of all, when I was in Iowa, I had done a solo record in 1990-91. You know, it sounds good. I co-produced it with Bo Ramsey, but it was before I moved to Nashville, and when I hear it now, all I hear is my pre-Nashville anxiety. But it was a good experience. When I moved here, when I was writing with Gwil, I had met a fellow who was interested in helping me. He and my father-in-law actually put together a little company, raised some money with which we made what would be that first record for Shaunakee, Cadillac Jack's number one son. Now along the way, after we had recorded that record, which Gary Talent produced, we were shopping it around, and I was still on the road playing, but I had nothing for my merch table. Inconceivable now. So about a year after that was done, we did put out an EP. It was a limited edition CD. It was an EP length thing. I think it was 7 songs, called Illinois 5 AM. It was through that we eventually got the deal with Shaunakee.
You were on the road playing your own stuff, or you were still supporting with others?
I was doing my own stuff. I was still trying to maintain a presence in the markets where I was playing in the Midwest while trying to figure out what the touring thing was all about. Mm-hmm. In a bigger sense, how to make it work. Lessons I wish I'd learned so much earlier, and I seem to be learning them. I'm just grateful that the illumination does come. You know, over the years, hopefully the touring has gotten smarter, healthier.
About touring, I mean, you know, now that it's not just let's go out and drink our bar tab, that there's the only thing they're actually paying us for the night. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but, you know, at some point you have to move beyond that to sustain a career. What works for you?
Just have to be smart in the driest sense. I tour solo about half the time, which seems to be the most economically viable way of getting the music out there. It's just a skill that I had to develop. When the first Shaunakee record came out, I was still trying to tour as a quartet. Living in a music business town, it's not like it's you and your 3 best friends driving to Chicago for the weekend. It's you and your 3 employees who have to be guaranteed a certain amount of money to get in the van. It's a competitive environment, you know. So, you know, I kind of ran head on into those kinds of issues. So now, you know, I kind of look at the solo thing as, you know, just a different way of getting the music out there, much quieter in the van. I can listen to, you know, unfinished tracks that I'm working on. It can be a good thing.
Is that what you do in terms of what you listen to while you're on the road by yourself?
Well, I'm ashamed to admit it, but yeah, just because the van tends to be, at least at this point, the best listening environment I mm-hmm. have in terms of being able to concentrate. So yeah, with, you know, hours of interstate in front of me, it's easy to kind of bear down on song fragment and think about it. I listen to other stuff too. It just depends on what kind of phase I'm in, if
sure.
I'm writing or if I'm not.
What led to your recent history of the most recent record with Glory Land? So what led up to you before that happened?
Well, I did two records for Shaunakee, and then it just became unfeasible to continue that relationship. It was a time when independent labels were caving left and right, so it just made more sense for me to go off on my own. I made the Burning record in 2005 with my friend Joe McMahon, who's been a good friend and producer for years and years now. We co-produced that record and then made Glory Land over, I think, about a 2.5-year period. Yeah, it took a while. Part of that was just trying to find the funds with which to make the record with, in terms of paying players and paying for studio time, etc. But part of it was deliberate. We knew that, well, Joe produced this one on his own, and he had a pretty clear idea of what he was going for. So we knew that this was going to be a more layered record, not as much dependent on the feel of a live performance or capturing a live performance. So we needed more time, and he would work on the record a lot on his own, say if it were guitar parts that a song needed or something. So we just kind of took our time. We would do some overdubs, and then we would not listen to it for a week or two, and then we'd listen to it. We'd think about it. So it seems incredibly decadent now to think about it, because it did take a while to get it out. I'm glad we did. The record's better because of it. Hi, this is Kevin Gordon, and you can find me on the internet at kevingordon.net.
That's a long period of time. Had you already written everything that you intended to be on it?
No. Now, I had some songs that I had written starting, I guess, 07, probably second half of 2006, I started writing again after the Burning record came out. But, I mean, up until the time we were tracking it, I was finishing Bus to Shreveport. I mean, literally writing that section at the end that is kind of the refrain, writing the music and the lyrics for that, you know, on the back of the lyrics I had beforehand in pencil. And as the band is, as we're sitting there waiting to hit record, this was at House of David Studio on Music Row. It's a cool studio in an old house. It doesn't feel like, you know, a laboratory environment. It's very cool. But there were a couple of things where it was like, oh, we don't have a solo section for this. This needs to go somewhere. So those are the times that kind of unnerve me more than anything. But, you know, also you can have some really happy accidents happen because right. You're not overthinking it. Hopefully.
With the luxury of time to record that, did you find yourself returning to songs repeatedly for revision?
Yes, for various reasons. Not so much lyrically as for production-related ideas or issues, such as Bus to Shreveport. That track is actually slowed down like half, like a quarter tone. It's not even a real note. what key it's in. It's somewhere between G and A, or somewhere in there. But the problem was, after listening to it, we decided that it sounded too peppy, you know, and that for what it was talking about, that it needed some kind of grunge and kind of a slower tempo. So by slowing the tape down, that does things sonically to the sound of certain instruments, including the drums, but also, you know, overall tonally made for a different sounding track.
How does that translate live then?
Well, let's see. I think I'm doing it in the key that we originally recorded it in. I think I play it in A, albeit at the slower tempo. Although, when I do it solo, it's kind of hard to play that same groove in a solo setting. I tend to do it more of like a Ramones thing, like a, you know, just kind of, you know, downstrokes, eighth notes on the guitar, more aggressive, which fits the song. You know, other than it being about a ZZ Top show, you know, the rest of it, you know, it fit in just fine.
just from the nature of the conversation, you would think, oh, someone who takes it solo is going to slow it down.
Maybe it is slower. That's an interesting thought. I'm going to have to find a live recording of me doing it solo if I have one, see how it compares to the track.
Specifically in terms of choosing both where to record and who to record with, what kind of sonic qualities were you going for in those decisions?
Originally, the idea we had was to actually do all the tracking at my friend Joe's home studio, which sounds more luxurious than it is. I mean, it's an old house with a bunch of really hot old analog gear stacked up against the walls instead of sofas and chairs. I mean, he's also set up for digital, too. And we knew we were going to use digital for this record just because it was going to be a more layered thing and much easier, practically speaking. But we ended up, we tracked three at first at his house and then didn't do the rest of the basic tracks until the following April. It would be April of 2009. And that's when we went to House of David. Just made a slight change as far as how we were approaching the thing. I mean, originally the idea was for me to go in and record a guitar and vocal track to a click track. You know, it just makes me want to climb the walls most of the time because I am not the most meter-centric guy. And we did that for the first three. But then we just figured out that maybe going for some of that live connection, bringing in two drummers to play together at the same time with the rest of the band, although being a very complicated thing to engineer, might make for better performances. So that's what we ended up doing.
As you were getting to the end of that long recording process, when did you know that we've got something that's going to become a cohesive unit now?
When we listened, it felt good. Lyrically, I still wasn't quite sure on the recording. I went back and redid the vocal, probably did do some revision on some of the words, but I just sort of had that feeling that there was enough good stuff in there, or stuff that felt good, lyrically and otherwise, that we had a song. Kind of played it for Joe as kind of an afterthought before we went in to track that April of 2009, where it was just me with him engineering at his house, and he just said, okay, play every song you're thinking about recording. Go. 20 songs later, I finished with that. Listening back to it, you know, it's a train wreck. You know, it's just me kind of going, and I think this goes, you know, his immediate response was, what the hell is that? You know, in a good, so he encouraged me to work a little harder on that one. I'm glad we did. It's a fun song to do. I had a very interesting brief conversation with my dad, but that's part of the fun back end of things.
In what way here?
Oh, that, you know, it was his half-brother who took me to the concert, the uncle. So, you know, we had a brief talk about past transgressions being forgiven, et cetera. The joys of adolescence. And I did learn a lot.
I'm sure you did.
Probably not exactly the things that my parents would have preferred that I learn, but...
There you are.
That's right. Hi, this is Kevin Gordon. I hope you'll check out my latest record, Glory Land, which you can find at my website, kevingordon.net, or at amazon.com.
Since this record has been out, what is changing about that music or any other of your music for you?
The response to the record has been wonderful. Press on this one, and the response has been fantastic. So I'm just trying to hang on, really.
Yeah.
I have started writing again. I've got a couple of new songs, partially. So, you know, yeah, it's already time to start.
Where are they headed?
One of the two songs is actually a song for my daughter.
She's
13. I know, I never write sentimental stuff, but I kind of made myself do this because it's something that, you know, is affecting me, her sort of going through the changes, you know, and I don't think she's heard it yet. She'd probably be terribly embarrassed. So that's kind of a pop song, really, in the way that I think of, like, somebody like Ron Sexsmith, kind of secretly try to imitate in situations like this. The other song is a very long narrative thing, kind of like Colfax, except darker and grungier. It's kind of assorted fables about things that happened in the town where I grew up, where it's going. It kind of scares me, actually. But it's good, you know? I'm trying to embrace that, kind of not knowing. We'll see. You know, the song about my daughter definitely being sort of living in the present tense, while the song about Monroe is just things I remember. You know, I worked as a bar back for, over a year. year at this place that I used to refer to as the Divorcee Bar. Yeah, it was called Little Caesars, actually, and it was all the Vegas you could conjure in Monroe.
But not the pizza chain.
That's right. No pizza.
Just to clarify.
Just really salty popcorn. You know, a wait staff that had definitely been around the bend once or twice. We're all too eager to share that information with a 19-year-old kid. So things like that are coming back, wanting to be talked about.
You just got back from Spain or somewhere, right? Where are you headed coming up in the next few months?
Well, I'm going back up east at least twice in the next couple of months. I'm also probably going back to the Midwest in the fall, going out to Oregon before the year's out, just trying to go everywhere, really.
Excellent. Do you have any places that you love to return just because of the sound or the crowd?
I love a place called Fitzgerald's in a suburb of Chicago called Berwyn. I say suburb. It's not really a suburb. It's just a town right outside of downtown on the southwest side. That's like one of the best music clubs in America, as far as I'm concerned. One of my current favorites. I'm playing the Birchmere with Todd Snyder soon. That's always a great room. And I love playing in the D.C. area as well. Pretty much like going everywhere.
Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate the opportunity to get to chat with you, Kevin.
Oh, well, you're welcome, Sloan. It's my pleasure.
Country Fried Rock. Find the full playlist from this episode on countryfriedrock.org. Check us out on iTunes. No music, just talk.
Our theme music is from The Full Tones.
Our Country Fried Rock stinger is from Steve Soto and the Twisted Hearts. Country Fried Rock.
Copyright 2012
by Lilypad Productions. All rights reserved.
Ever he been helping us from Country Fried Rock.